You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The demographics within California prisons are not reflective of the diversity of the state. According to the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC, the imprisonment rate for African-American men is 10 times that of white men. And although African-American men are less than 6% of the state's overall population, they make up more than 28% of the prison population. Our next guest would argue this dynamic was developed over centuries and goes well beyond California. America's system of mass incarceration isn't even confined to the borders of the United States. Dr. Benjamin Weber is a historian and African-American studies professor at UC Davis and argues that throughout history, incarceration became a tool that America used to colonize and control other populations in pursuit of global power, from indigenous tribes and slavery to once territories like the Philippines, Panama, and elsewhere. Professor Weber has written a new book that is tracking these developments, as well as the resistance and protest movements that exist to this day. It's called American Purgatory, Prison Imperialism, and the Rise of Mass Incarceration. Dr. Weber joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Vicky. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, thank you for making the time. So before we dive into your new book, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved and interested in the fields of history and African-American studies?
Yeah, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, involved in racial justice and environmental justice issues. And I came of age politically amid the two crises of our time. I was involved in student walkouts around the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan at the, in 2001 and 2003. And then, acutely aware of racially targeted mass incarceration being a kind of world unprecedented, locking up people at world unprecedented rates. And I really found that African-American history and Black studies had the framework that was missing for me, that helped me put it all together in college and after college. I was lucky to have some great mentors. And actually, my college roommate's father was a Black studies professor whose work sent me in search of root causes in the first place.
When it comes to this book that was just published this fall, when did you start thinking about this? What sparked this idea? And how long does it go back? I would imagine it was a great deal of work.
Yeah. I mean, I've been working on it for a decade, the research and the writing. But I think the seed was planted a decade earlier, as I mentioned, in high school for me, when I became really aware of these issues and the interconnections between overseas war making and technologies of control and punishment at home.
A term that you use is prison imperialism. How do you want people to understand what that is?
Yeah, it's a central term. It kind of provides a through line for the book. And it's an unspoken doctrine that names the connections between foreign policy and prison policy. And so there are different ways to trace this over a long, over four centuries, essentially. One way to think about it, your listeners may be familiar with the use of prison slavery, that in law it says slavery and involuntary servitude cannot be used as punishment, except as punishment for crime. And a lot of people may know that originated with the 13th Amendment at the end of the Civil War, but it actually originated with the Northwest Ordinance in 1787. So, and so one of the things the book looks at is how the use of prison slavery, starting in 1787, written into state and federal law all the way up to today, was applied not only within the United States, but to any place subject to their jurisdiction. And so over successive eras of empire building, those places subject to U.S. jurisdiction came to be the Philippines, Panama, a vast expanse of land across North America. And so one way to think about the convict clause, the use of prison slavery, is that it's the longest lasting and furthest reaching piece of federal prison policy, and that it developed in empire, essentially.
And I would imagine when reading some of your work, when you were looking at, examples here within the United States, I mean, there are parallels to these other territories as the United States, America, was expanding abroad.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the striking things is you can see, you know, the way that these foreign policy and prison policy doctrines are implemented on the ground means that plantation labor at somewhere like Iwahig Penal Farm in the Philippines, which is the largest prison penal colony in the world by the 1920s, a U.S.-run prison in the Philippines, looks a lot like plantation labor at Parchman Farm in Mississippi. And the same kinds of chain gangs and, you know, highly visible and degrading physical labor that was used to structure racial hierarchy in the South after the Civil War during what's known as the convict leasing era was also being used to produce and structure racial hierarchy in places like the Panama Canal Zone, where the prison population quickly became about 80% people of African descent. And in this case, Caribbean migrants who had come to work on the canal. So from Barbados, Martinique, places like that. And of course, this was called out by intellectuals and activists at the time, people like Emmy Césaire and Garvey, who was down there at the time. And so things like the silver worker strike, in the Panama Canal Zone, was in part a protest to this unjust criminal legal system that was exported to the zone. And certain provisions, like the use of prison slavery, were exported there, while other constitutional protections, like the right to a jury trial, were not.
Mm. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, this idea sparked for you like 2 decades ago. You began researching this and working on this a decade ago. You're a professor of African American studies. But even with all of that context, as you were doing that research and just seeing how far these lineages kind of transcend beyond, you know, the borders of the United States, did you find that surprising when looking at the Philippines and Panama and what takes place here?
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of surprising connections that surfaced in the book. You know, part of it for folks who are trained in Black studies and have read a lot of this stuff, some of the kind of continuation of racial violence is less surprising. But there are these really surprising things that come up in the records, in the archives. So, you know, I was looking through records in Bilibid Prison in the Philippines from the period of U.S. occupation, and there are all these instances where they're looking for a messianic leader, essentially a messiah capable of leading the anti-colonial freedom movement in the Philippines, the Katipunan Brotherhood, who arose first to fight Spanish colonialism and then U.S. Imperialism. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, the parallels between counterinsurgency doctrine, the way that they're thinking about trying to suppress the rise of a messiah in the Philippines. And then, of course, we're familiar with the, you know, 1960s and 70s, the rise of a Black Messiah, the new film about Judas and the Black Messiah. And of course, the FBI, you know, Director Hoover's illegal COINTELPRO program, which targeted the rise of any Black messiah. And they had identified, you know, Malcolm X and Fred Hampton and other people. And so one of the surprising things is that the way that military doctrine, the way that certain forms of counterinsurgency and targeted control are developed through overseas war making and colonialism, then come back and are used very explicitly in the United States in ways that are not always acknowledged.
Mm. When it comes to the title of your book, you use the word purgatory. What went into the choice of using that word for the title?
Yeah, there's, you know, there's a kind of glib answer, which is a very good friend of mine, William Chiriguayo, who's a master wordsmith, kind of came up with that title on the back of a napkin in New York City when we were talking through the book. But the deeper answer is that people in prison describe their condition as a kind of purgatory, and people who have experienced colonial rule, so also in the records from the periods of U.S. occupation in the Philippines and elsewhere in Puerto Rico. And purgatory, you know, in the prison memoirs and things is used to describe a kind of feeling of being suspended between deliverance and damnation. And that kind of idea of being suspended, these degrees of freedom, these kind of, you know, is also comes up in the way that people talk about colonial rule, that you have to prove your fitness for self-rule constantly, and that measure moves in the same way that you have to prove your fitness for freedom in the prison system. And then also colonial administrators and prison guards and wardens wrote about the relationship between prisons as a kind of purgatory. And so both because it came up in the language of the people and the records described in the book, and because it kind of names the existential condition of justice in this country where, you know, people have really lost faith and it's suspended in a kind of period between damnation and deliverance. Right.
Purgatory.
Now. Yep.
Is this uniquely an American creation and system? I mean, when you look at, I don't know, other empires in history?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, in the early period, you see that the U.S. is exchanging ideas in these conferences, like the International Penal Conference and the International Prison and Penitentiary Commission. And these are precursors to international organizations like the U.N. Commission on Crimes and Drugs, which, you know, this story for a separate time, but gets kind of co-opted by the Nazis in 1935. But early on, they're exchanging these ideas about prison systems, developing an empire. They're exchanging ideas with people in other empires. So there are certainly borrowing around the idea. There's a debate in 1872 at the first conference about the use of criminal transportation, and they're looking to the British, you know, use in Australia. There's a debate about penal colonies. So one of the things that you usually associate with prison systems in empire is the establishment of a penal colony. And because the U.S. never officially had a penal colony, even though, of course, we already talked about they had these prison farms in the Philippines, when they purchased Alaska, it was rumored to have been a penal colony. And there's in the book talks about this early schemes for a penal colony in the 19th century between Jefferson and Monroe, which we could talk about as the Jefferson-Monroe Penal Doctrine, where they wanted to. So the use of banishment, the use of claiming new territories to establish a prison system, some of that comes through borrowings with other empires, certainly.
Hmm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Benjamin Weber, a historian and UC Davis professor, as well as author of the new book, American Purgatory, Imperialism and the Rise of Mass Incarceration. I mean, when looking overseas at these U.S. territories, you know, or once U.S. territories, some still are U.S. territories, how do you see the impact today of this prison imperialism in places that you mentioned, like the Philippines and Panama?
Yeah, yeah, and also Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and other places. You know, there are a number of ways to look at the legacies or the continued workings of prison imperialism. One is the way that the U.S. continues to export technologies of e-carceration, so, you know, at border checkpoints and prisons. Another is the what's been called the globalization of the supermax prison, beginning within the U.S. and then exporting it to other countries around the world. And then the book kind of gestures towards the way that the rise of e-carceration and these electronic systems is prison imperialism's next frontier. And so and the other way to think about it is that some of these logics and these core doctrines, the overlap between foreign policy and prison policy, have remained the same. So things, the logic of deterrence and preemption, containment and incapacitation, retribution and rehabilitation, some of those core doctrines and theories and assumptions in these major fields have remained surprisingly unchanged. Mm. And so that's another way that it plays out in the present.
Yeah, so that was going to be my next question, because you're also a historian. You know, why is it important to look at history through this lens of mass incarceration?
Yeah, you know, in Black studies, there's a kind of commitment and a moral responsibility to look both at root causes and continued workings, and also to look at the protest tradition. So the book, while it broadens how we think about the origins of this crisis and looks at some of the streams that we may have missed internationally. It also lifts up a long and powerful protest tradition of people who internationalized the struggle against prison imperialism, against prison expansion, because that commitment to doing both, to kind of looking at a history of dialectical relationship between kind of forces of oppression and forces of resistance and protest. And so the other piece of the story is that we have a lot of really important stuff to learn from people who internationalized the struggle and had an international framework for thinking about freedom movements.
What kind of progress or solutions have taken place during this time period?
Yeah, you know, there are these kind of moments that I describe in the book that show glimmers of hope and things that we can learn from. So as far back as the Black Fort, which was a beacon for Maroon and, you know, enslaved people, fugitives from slavery, all the way up through, you know, moments where Assata Shakur is standing with the Indians of all tribes during their occupation of Alcatraz. And, you know, in that moment, they're acknowledging a kind of global and local solution or theory about, you know, the alternatives to this, which, you know, they say this land could be much better used as a spiritual and cultural center. And so it's grounded in placemaking, but it's also appealing to the world. And so those kind of things. And then there's, you know, other examples of that. There's, you know, the activists who have gone to the UN to kind of internationalize the struggle, the appeals to the world from political prisoners, you know, from right here in the Bay Area, what those kind of moments in the book show is a genealogy of thinking about freedom and justice and alternatives to prison that center self-determination and that kind of appeal to human rights and an expanded framework of human rights that there's a long genealogy of in the Black radical tradition.
I think about even recently with the California Reparations Task Force, and this isn't the first time reparations have been done in our country's history. There are reparations for, you know, Japanese Americans who were incarcerated during World War II. I mean, what do you think this moment, because this is the most recent piece, it's also, there's a lot of debate surrounding reparations as well. Do you think this fits into this history that you've laid out over the centuries?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that, you know, the State Task Force report presents an opportunity to think really expansively about repair and to go back to these histories of what Black intellectuals and activists have fought for. So there's lots of examples in the book. There's lots of other really excellent work coming out on activist histories of reparations. What have Black groups and fought for over centuries, and what? How do we repair massive historic harm and trauma? And so, you know, in that report, there's a big section on the criminal legal system, on health, on, you know, these different areas. And so, one of the things that is exciting is that it provides this opportunity to rethink, repair, to reimagine those things. And the other thing is that it calls on us to accord with international precedent. And so to dig into those examples, to think about that international framework as we do that, because, you know, Black studies has always had a global framework, a transnational framework, attending to the lives of Black people worldwide. And the genealogy of scholars and activists outlined in this book, you know, back through Claudia Jones and, you know, all the way through, have always thought about how to repair these historic injustices and wrongs. And the other thing is, you know, to one of, you know, the things that comes out is that they've always centered land and self-determination, so that there's a kind of a groundedness in these struggles for alternatives.
Thank you so much, Professor Weber.
Thank you.
Dr. Benjamin Weber is the author of American Purgatory, Prison Imperialism and the Rise of Mass Incarceration, and is a professor of history and African American studies at UC Davis. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.